You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Good ideas are easy to recognize. They're often simple, elegant, and in retrospect, obvious. Stephen Johnson's new book, Where Good Ideas Come From, explores those environments and conditions that inspire creative thinking. Mr. Johnson claims that there are patterns surrounding the development of all good ideas and that those patterns can be cultivated. The book is published by Riverhead Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. So if good ideas are obvious in retrospect, how did you come up with the idea for this book?
Well, you know, it comes out of a book that I wrote about 4 or 5 years ago, actually, I think we talked about it, called The Ghost Map. And The Ghost Map was it was a book about a cholera epidemic in London in the 1850s. And I got interested in this story because there was this kind of epic intellectual investigation and this brilliant kind of lone genius who figured out where the cholera was coming from in the water by making a map. And I thought it would be a really fun story to tell, and it would be kind of like a Victorian episode of CSI, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I went to research it, it turned out, in fact, that it wasn't this kind of eureka moment. In fact, this guy, John Snow, had this theory of cholera that it was waterborne for years and years and years. He'd been working on the theory for a very long time. And in fact, he had a collaborator that no one ever talked about who was kind of crucial in bringing a whole different set of skills to the problem and really helped him kind of solve this mystery. And so I realized as I was writing that story that there was kind of this latent theory about innovation and breakthrough ideas. And I thought it would be kind of fun to put that front and center in this book.
In so many of these cases, the breakthrough occurs when people are talking to each other. We have Watson and Crick, for example. Even though other people were on the verge of figuring it out, it was those conversations. Here's another example. But in the case of Darwin, was there anybody? You begin the book with Darwin's trick to the Keeling Islands. Most people, I think, would probably started with the Galapagos Islands.
Well, it's all part of that same kind of voyage. I started it there in the Keeling Islands because Darwin's first great scientific idea was understanding the formation of tropical atolls, which are actually built out of coral reefs. And he had this kind of a genius kind of breakthrough in understanding that. And there's a theme in the book about coral reefs because coral reefs are unusually innovative biological spaces, and they share a bunch of properties with some of the other systems that I look at. In terms of Darwin's great insight, the idea of natural selection, I talk about it at some length because the story that Darwin himself told about his breakthrough was a classic story of eureka moment, a kind of sudden flash of insight. And he actually wrote about it in his autobiography, reading Malthus one night in late 1838, and suddenly the idea pops into his head and he has a theory. But it turns out
inspired by Malthus?
Yeah, reading Malthus' book on population. And for 130 years, that was the canonical story about how Darwin came up with the idea. The scholars would call it the Malthusian epiphany, right? But then about 20 years ago, a wonderful scholar named Howard Gruber, who's kind of an intellectual historian and psychologist, went back and looked at all of Darwin's notebooks. And it turned out that actually, well, you can see the day he has this kind of alleged epiphany. It turns out that Darwin actually has the idea in pretty much full-dress form in his notebooks for months and months and months leading up to the epiphany. And but he doesn't really even talk about it as his theory, as this thing that he has for another 2 months after. And so the point of this is that, in fact, eureka moments, even if Darwin talked about it this way, are generally pretty misleading. And then, in fact, most great ideas have a long incubation period. And in the book, I call these the slow hunch.
And Darwin took a long time to publish everything.
Well, he was scared. Once he realized the idea he had, he was scared. You know, he wasn't quite sure what to do with it.
What did Darwin find so striking in the coral colonies and in the surrounding water?
Well, there's this thing called Darwin's paradox, actually, which is that coral reefs are tremendous engines of biodiversity. They make up less than 1% of the landmass of the planet, but they have something like 25% of the species, marine species, live in these coral reefs. So they're the cities of the sea, basically. And there's a puzzle about that because they shouldn't, by rights, actually be that populated because the waters of a coral reef are actually pretty nutrient poor. And so the question is, why are they able to sustain all this amazing kind of biodiversity? And it turns out that they are very good at, as a system, as an ecosystem, extremely good at collaborating. And so, you know, they're really good at kind of recycling other organisms' waste and figuring out little niches. The coral polyps build these amazing kind of skeletons that allow other organisms to live in homes and things like that. And so they're quite like the kind of intellectual environments that you see in, say, dense cities, where there's a lot of recycling of other people's ideas. There's a lot of collaboration. There's a lot of borrowing from one person and porting it over into a new domain.
And I would assume that universities are the equivalent of coral reefs as well.
Yeah, and in some sense, that's one of the big arguments of the book is that when we look at the kind of long history of innovation, we have this assumption in our society, particularly that the marketplace and kind of commercial firms and entrepreneurs really drive innovation, and that largely innovation comes out of the kind of competitive clash between private firms. And one of the things I'm trying to point out is that, in fact, there is a long tradition of big ideas coming out of more open, connective environments like universities.
And if a hit movie is to be believed, Facebook comes out of the desire to meet girls.
Right, exactly.
Wasn't it Huxley who said after learning of Darwin's ideas about evolution, it's so obvious, why didn't I think of
yeah,
it?
Yeah, he says, "How?" No, I love this, one of my favorite lines in intellectual history. He said, how incredibly stupid not to have thought of that. Which is,
But we don't we often feel that yeah. way when we read something, when we hear of something that seems so obvious and yet never occurred to anybody until that moment, or at least you might have felt it. The zeitgeist might have been hinting at it.
Yeah.
But then somebody really comes up with the complete idea.
Yeah, the zeitgeist is I think the really interesting part of it. In the book, I talk about this idea of the adjacent possible, which is this wonderful phrase from Stuart Kaufman, the scientist. And Kaufman's idea is that in any given point, both in the history of life and the history of human society, there are a set of kind of possible moves that you can make given the existing ideas and the existing technologies. It's like a chessboard. In the middle of a chess game, there's a set of finite moves you can make. There are a much larger set of moves you can't make, right? And so in the history of technology, for instance, it's impossible to come up with a microwave oven in 1650, right? You just can't do it. You have to wait for a number of subsequent steps for this to become possible. But at any given moment, there are kind of – at the point at which science advances – new technologies advance, certain ideas are circulating in the air, suddenly certain kinds of thoughts become thinkable for the first time. And those are the thoughts where somebody has them and then you hear them and you say, of course, right, that makes sense.
Although we also sometimes even have situations where two people come up with the same idea at the same time, don't even know that they're developing because there's a need, like calculus.
Yeah, there's a need, but also they have platforms that have been built beneath them that allow them to kind of think these thoughts. Like in my last book, I talked about Joseph Priestley, who's kind of most famous for isolating oxygen for the first time. And it turns out actually there are kind of three people who did it, including Priestley, right around the same time. And the reason why it was possible to isolate oxygen for the first time is that there were tools, new forms of scales that allow you to kind of burn and weigh, measure things much more precisely than before. And as a field, studying the composition of the air was something that had just occurred to people. No one had really thought about that the idea that the air was made up of something before, you know, 1750 or so. And so Priestley and these other people were able to start thinking about this as a problem because of these kind of previous investigations. And that's why suddenly three people independently came across the same idea.
Although we also have this odd thing where we have relativity and quantum mechanics developing at the same time because there are all sorts of things that Newtonian physics can handle. But they become antithetical to each other.
Yeah, and that's part of the process of kind of accumulating ideas, and this is the way that, you know, science advances. You build this new paradigm or this new platform, and then you kind of knock on the edges of it, basically, and you see where the trapdoors are, where the kind of the false leads, or where the theory starts to fall apart.
Well, you were talking about how an idea might be there, but it doesn't necessarily come together. You write about Charles Babbage, who pretty much understood the idea of the computer way before its time.
Yeah, Babbage is a great case study in the limits of possibility at a given time. So Babbage was a kind of visionary kind of designer and came up with really two key inventions. One was a kind of a high-tech advanced calculator in the early 1800s called the difference engine. And then he subsequently pretty much invented the programmable computer with Ada Lovelace, who was the first software programmer, Lord Byron's daughter, interestingly. And he tried to build this thing called the analytical engine, and he had all of the core ideas of a modern computer. He had the idea of a central processing unit and of RAM and of the idea of storing software in RAM and things like that. But the problem was he was trying to build a digital age machine with industrial era parts, right? He needed to make it work, he needed to have, you know, at least vacuum tubes, and it would be even better if he had integrated circuits and silicon chips and so on. Instead, he was trying to make it work with steam power and, you know, clanking gears and things like that. And so it wasn't possible in a sense to really build this machine given the adjacent possible of that technology. And so the ideas actually died out, and many of them had to be rediscovered independently, you know, 70 years later when people actually started to build computers.
Well, you would think that it would have remained in the air until it was possible, but it took until World War II before anybody actually rediscovered it.
Yeah, and that tends to be what happens when people get kind of too far ahead of the kind of constraints of their time. Is there just there's no kind of room for the idea, and so it just kind of withers away, and people have to rediscover it independently.
Did the same thing happen with some of these other things that you write about? For example, the incubator.
Well, the incubator, no, that has kind of a direct. The incubator is a great example of borrowing a technology from one space and moving it over into another domain, which is one of the big patterns that you see again and again in the history of ideas. And this is a wonderful story about this French doctor. In Paris in the 19th century, Paris is, you know, second largest city in the world, was seeing terrible infant mortality rates. Urbanization was causing all these problems. And he goes for a walk in the Paris Zoo, and he sees these little chicken incubators in the zoo with little eggs, you know, little hatchlings. And he suddenly thinks, wait a second, hold on. Maybe we could take that technology and port it over and use it with newborns, particularly premature babies. And he actually has one of the guys at the zoo help make this, you know, kind of prototype for the incubator. And it ends up kind of taking off and becomes, you know, one of the most amazing kind of medical advances of the last 100 years.
But that was in Paris. It still hasn't made inroads in parts of the developing world.
Yeah, this is maybe one of my very favorite stories in the book, because one of the problems that you have with the developing world, where you do continue to see terrible infant mortality rates, is even if you ship a state-of-the-art incubator into a, you know, mid-sized village somewhere in Africa, you'll have it work for a year or two or something like that, and then it will break. And because there's no, you know, spare parts on the ground, and because the you know, people don't have the kind of repair expertise to fix something like this, it'll just be useless, basically. So a couple of years ago, this amazing group called Design That Matters, led by Timothy Prestero at MIT, decided to create this incubator kind of designed for the limitations of that environment. And they realized that the technology, you know, on the ground in a developing world context, yeah, they may not have microwaves and DVRs, but they seem to be able to keep the cars running, right? There's a Toyota 4Runner on the ground in all these places. And so they decided to make an incubator out of car parts. And they made this amazing thing called the NeoNurture. It's heated by headlights, uses a car battery, it uses door chimes for alarms and things like that. And all you need to have are the spare parts for a car and the knowledge of how to fix a car, and you can repair this incubator. And I love that. Just one, it's a great idea, but I think it's also a great way of thinking about how great ideas work, which is they are often cobbled together from existing spare parts that we have, from existing tools or existing ideas or things that we've borrowed from another domain and brought over. And in some sense, being creative, being innovative is about these works of bricolage, about remixing other things and putting them into new combinations.
Of course, that also means that village may never get attain the kind of expertise that's necessary to make the big technological breakthrough.
Well, you know, if you can cut infant mortality rates in half, which an incubator can do in many cases, you're going to have a lot higher quality of life, and you're going to start building a stable foundation for growth and development, and hopefully you'll develop those technologies down the line.
Stephen Johnson is the author of the bestsellers The Invention of Air, The Ghost Map, Everything Bad is Good for You, Mind Wide Open. His latest is called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation, and it's published by Riverhead Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Stephen Johnson. His latest book, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation, published by Riverhead. Who was Max Kleber?
Max Kleber was a really interesting scientist who formulated Kleber's Law, which becomes one of the kind of basic principles of biology. And that is that basically as organisms grow larger, their metabolism slows down. So in terms of kind of heartbeats per second and things like that, which is this observation he discovered. And it's a very kind of linear process. You can just kind of predict exactly as things get bigger, they slow down, which has this interesting corollary, which is organisms tend to have the same number of heartbeats per lifetime.
But does that affect lifespan? For example, whales and elephants can live rather long lives.
Yes,
but when you talk about dogs, small dogs and big dogs tend to die younger than medium-sized.
Exactly,
dogs.
But their heartbeats are slower, the larger animals as well. So it all kind of evens out in this kind of funny way, whereas very small organisms have extremely fast metabolisms, but they die out much, much more quickly. Now, it comes up in the book because a few years ago, a wonderful scholar named Jeffrey West, who used to be the head of the Santa Fe Institute, decided to see if Kleber's Law applied to the superorganisms of cities. What about how cities work? Did they have a similar process as they got bigger? And it turned out actually that with some things like, you know, out of energy, transportation and roads and things like that, that there were some principles that seemed to apply from Kleber's Law. But what he found that broke from this, which was very interesting and it's kind of the centerpiece at the beginning of the book, is that as cities grew larger, they interestingly grew disproportionately more creative and innovative. And so a city that was 10 times larger than another city didn't tend to be 10 times more creative or innovative. It turned out to be 30 times more creative or innovative.
But that would mean that Cairo and Mexico City are a lot more innovative than New York City.
Well, you want to compare it within a given kind of culture, right? So compare a large Mexico City as an example to smaller Mexican towns, you would find that Mexico City was much more innovative within the kind of paradigms of that particular culture.
And when you say innovative, what do you mean?
They look at patents. They look at kind of new businesses that are started. They look at kind of the creative arts. And, you know, there's kind of six or seven different measures of innovation.
But doesn't it usually follow that if a city is big, it becomes a center and artists will move to it?
Yeah, that is true. But the question is, I think it's one of these things where we have to think about why. Why did the artists are drawn there? Because big cities generally are open to creative ideas or seem to foster creative ideas. So why?
And you're going to meet more people who are similar to you.
Yeah, that's true. And what you end up doing is –
we're back to those reefs.
Right. And you end up having these very kind of dense networks and you have diversity. And diversity is one of the keys here. This is the non-political argument for the importance of diversity because – there have been a number of studies that have shown that unusually innovative people, one of the kind of signature patterns in their lives is that they have kind of weak tie acquaintances and friends who belong to a kind of diverse range of professions. So they themselves may work in an ad agency somewhere, but they know a plumber and a poet and a popular science writer and a government contract lawyer. And it's through all those interesting conversations with people who are different from them that new ideas are sparked and new approaches are parked. And dense cities make it a lot easier to have those unusual kind of diverse connections than
more than
towns.
A small town where you're likely to have a plumber and a bookshop owner and a butcher.
Yeah, but there's so many – this is an old Jane Jacobs point actually from Death and Life of the Great American Cities is that she has this great point where she says one of the paradoxical effects of large cities is that they encourage the very small. So very small niches, very small kind of shops devoted to very specific interests, very kind of precise subcultures can flourish in big cities because there's enough of kind of population base that you can find people who share this same kind of small interest.
So you say a good idea is really a network.
Yeah, we need to get – in order to understand where ideas come from, we need to get outside of this idea that an idea is a single thing.
A eureka moment
happening in one mind, that there are almost always implicit or explicit collaborations between people. And to facilitate them in your own lives, you have to put yourself in environments where those networks can trigger them more effectively.
But even your own brain is a network.
That's right. I mean, on some basic level, a new idea is, you know, a bunch of other ideas firing in sync with each other for the first time, a network of neurons firing in sync with each other for the first time. So how do you get those new networks to connect for the first time. And sometimes one way to do it is through kind of serendipity, through kind of surprise. Sometimes it's through mistakes. I mean, I have a whole chapter in the book about the importance of error in both scientific research and creative research, where people are kind of seeking out a particular solution to a problem and they make a mistake. But the mistake opens up a kind of a new door and a new avenue to explore.
Well, and often helps somebody else. For example, there's a new book about jet planes, and Haviland came up with the first modern jet, but we don't have Haviland jets around anymore. They almost perfected it, but then there were some things that went wrong, and Boeing came along and figured out what was going wrong. And we see that again and again and again. It's the reason that Microsoft has done so well. It's the reason that Google has outstripped Yahoo.
Yeah, it's true. And if you look at the social network, the story of Facebook in that movie, which is somewhat fictionalized but somewhat not. I mean, it's really important to the story to point out two things. One, that Zuckerberg did not invent the idea of social networks, that he was borrowing a kind of concept of a certain site that existed before in Friendster and MySpace. And there were big things there. So he was learning from other people's models. And it was also that this is the power of the web and the internet, that he was able to build on a platform that supported him in all sorts of ways, right? He didn't have to invent the internet. He didn't have to invent the web. These were open platforms where it was easy for one kid or a couple of kids to get together and create a site that would change the world. Precisely because it was an open platform, precisely it was a platform where you could borrow both tools and ideas from other services and turn it into something new. Whenever you have environments that are set up that way, you'll see an explosion of innovation precisely because the openness allows innovation to flourish.
So everybody knew that it was a matter of coming up with good logarithms, but then the trick is to come up with the good logarithm.
Yes, exactly.
Well, there is always this push and pull between people wanting to keep their the things that they've done secret and others who say everything should be open.
I think what we want to have is just a slightly better sense of balance. I mean, this book is obviously arguing that, you know, there is this role for connective environments and we shouldn't spend so much time protecting our ideas and keeping them secret. But the model that I have in the book that I think is a really inspiring one is Nike created this thing called Green Exchange for all of their intellectual property they had in their R&D labs that was they were working on that was environmentally sustainable in some way. And they wanted to share that. They wanted people who weren't necessarily competitive with them to be able to take these ideas and make the world a better place by taking their ideas and putting them to some new use. And so they worked with Creative Commons, and they created this thing called Green Exchange, and they created basically a new license to work with the patents there so that people could take their ideas very simply, and as long as they weren't making sneakers, as long as they weren't making something that was competitive with Nike's core business, they could take the ideas and port them over and make tires, say, which Nike isn't in the business of tires. So it wasn't a question of eliminating, say, patents altogether. There's a role for patents, for sure, and patents are partially about disclosure as well as protection. But it's about trying to find that kind of better balance where ideas are allowed to kind of migrate across domains of expertise and fields so that they can be put to new uses.
And there we come back to cities, because cities invite applications for the environment that's available. It's all over. It's all around us, whereas in a small town, I've lived in small towns, sometimes you got to wait a while to get the thing. Although today that's changed a bit, hasn't it? Because anybody can use the internet.
The internet has very city-like properties to it. It's chaotic. There's a lot of awful things happening there. but it also is very creative, and it allows people to kind of share. There's a great term that economists have, which is information spillover. When you have kind of dense networks in real life or online, when minds get together, good ideas have this natural tendency to spill over from mind to mind, and there's something very powerful in that.
My guest is Stephen Johnson. His latest book, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. It's published by Riverhead. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What's the 10-10 rule?
The 10-10 rule is we have this kind of received idea in our society that technology has just been accelerating at this ever-increasing kind of clip. But if you look at the history of 20th century technology, you see that, in fact, most new technologies, starting with, the radio and the telephone, television, DVR, things like that, take about 10 years to be developed into a mature form, and then they take about 10 years to go mainstream as a kind of consumer product. So the general cycle is about 20 years to go from idea to mainstream. And what happened with the web is that the web actually seems to have kind of broken that law. And you look at something like YouTube, which, you know, utterly transformed the web, made the web into a true video medium in a way that it wasn't before. And YouTube took about a year or two to build, and it took about a year or two to become one of the top 10 sites on the web. And so instead of 10-10, you've got kind of 2-2. And so part of the question I'm trying to wrestle with, just as cities have proven to be so innovative, why has the web been so innovative? And I think it's precisely because it's that kind of connective environment where you can build on ideas and platforms that other people have created.
But of course, things speed up a lot. Anyway, it took a while for cities to develop.
Right.
And then and once you had cities, it took a while for some of the things we associate with cities to develop.
Well, I have a chart in the book, actually, of the 70,000 years leading up to cities. And yes, it's true, the timescales are slightly different. But right after cities form, there is this amazing explosion in innovation, basically. There are all these things, aqueducts and alphabets and currency forms that are invented right after cities are invented. And so right as when cities are invented, basically, human beings come up with a new way of inventing things, basically. And so you can see that power, that same acceleration at work right after the first cities formed.
And then in time, we wind up with proximity and with people together, we wind up with the Renaissance. And we wind up with exchanges of ideas between one city in Belgium and another city in Italy.
It's not an accident that northern Italy, you know, the birthplace of the Renaissance, was the most urbanized place in the world at that particular point, and that they were kind of a trading center. That, you know, you look at Venice in that period and Genoa and places like that.
So it's tied to the rise of capitalism?
It is tied to the rise of capitalism.
And you have that in Dutch art as well, where Vermeer and Rembrandt come out of a whole change in the way the merchant class sees itself.
Yeah, and it absolutely is tied in. But there's one thing that it's important to say. I think when people hear that those explosions of innovation are tied to the birth of capitalism, they assume that means that because people are economically incentivized, they focus more, they come up with better ideas. And that is, I'm sure, partially true. The corrective to that, though, is to point out that what happens when you move into a capitalist state is that the network of minds involved in solving a problem grows much larger. When you have a whole marketplace that is innovative instead of, you know, a feudal lord.
And there was a marketplace of ideas that led to the Renaissance, because part of what led to it was the fight between various religious orders, with the Dominicans fighting the Franciscans, and the next thing you know, they're all appealing to people and hiring artists to glorify themselves.
The kind of productive chaos that often leads to breakthrough ideas.
On the other hand, Goethe said, you quote him, "The invention of double entry accounting is the finest invention of the human mind."
I know, it's
funny. Here's this great artist who writes The Sorrows of Young Werther, who's thinking about double entry accounting.
Yes, he had a hidden accountant lurking inside him. Little did we know. But it was true. I mean, it's one of the engines of capitalism was figuring out where the money was and keeping track of it. But it seems like double entry and counting itself, while it was crucial to capitalism, was this practice that was kind of collectively invented by all these kind of merchants, and it was passed around. There's no kind of clear owner of double entry accounting. Just like the city is really not owned by anyone, but it creates a space where capitalism and private firms can flourish.
When you talk about a hunch, are you and you do write about hunches leading to great ideas, are you talking about the same thing that Malcolm Gladwell wrote about in Blink?
No. In some ways, I'm talking about the opposite. I mean, I think everything that Malcolm said in that book is right. But that was a book about instant impressions and gut impressions. And
you're talking about slow hunches?
I'm talking about the slow hunch. Think about the World Wide Web as a great example. Tim Berners-Lee spent almost a decade working on the project that would become the World Wide Web. And it was because he had a work environment where he could sit there and allow this hunch he had that there was some interesting problem that he could solve. He was able to let it kind of linger in the background as a side project. He didn't even tell his bosses about it for about the first 7 years. And then finally, as it started to mature, he kind of came in and said, "Listen, I think maybe I've invented a whole new medium. Maybe you should let this be part of my job."
Is there a theory that the digital age will stamp out serendipity?
I hear this a lot. It's kind of an argument I've been having with people for about 10 years now. There are people who think that the web is more of a filtered echo chamber-like environment where you only encounter things that you're looking for and people who share your same views.
Different from going through the dictionary or the encyclopedia and something that you weren't looking for suddenly catches your eye and a light bulb goes on.
Yeah, and this book is a celebration of serendipitous discoveries. That's one of the core values of it, and surprise and chance. But I just don't understand what medium these people have been using, because it seems to me that the web – I'm constantly sitting down at the web and starting looking for something, and then 3 hours later I'm reading a Wikipedia entry on monarch butterflies, which I didn't expect to do. I mean, the web is brilliant at taking you to unexpected places.
I just want to talk about one more thing. There are so many things that I wish we had time to talk about. The word that Stephen Jay Gould invented, acceptation.
Yeah, yeah. And Elizabeth Verba, too. They came up with it together. It's a biological term from kind of evolutionary theory. And the idea is that a lot of innovation in biology in evolution comes from a trait or a feature that evolved for one purpose but then turned out to be kind of surprisingly useful at something else. Feathers are a great example. Originally evolved for warmth, turned out to be really helpful for flying. And actually, if you look at the history of culture and technology, acceptation is the rule. It's technologies or ideas that were designed for one thing that get migrated over and turn out to be good for something else.
For example, Gutenberg coming up with his printing press. The movable type had been invented by the Chinese, but he wasn't using their kind of press.
And yeah, he didn't. He basically borrowed. He stumbled across this ancient technology, the screw press, which was being used by vintners to press grapes. And he looked at this thing and said, "Oh my gosh, I can make this. I can make Bibles with this."
Just one more thing, because my producer asked me to ask you this: Google's 20% rule.
Google's 20% rule is a kind of a hunch cultivating mechanism. They encourage people to spend 20% of their time working on whatever they want. And all they have to do is kind of report to their superiors to say, hey, here's how my project is going. And Google gets a lot of shipping commercial products out of that free time.
Why is it that I fear that if Google and Apple ever work out their differences, they're going to take over the world?
It is very funny that those two companies are as powerful as they are. If you'd gone back 10 years and said that, it would have been a big surprise.
Stephen Johnson's latest book is called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. It's published by Riverhead Books. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.